Okay, we've been out of the routine for a few weeks, and so let me just take a couple of minutes to refresh our memories of exactly where we are. Of course, the Israelites, they had been taken off into captivity in three waves, in fact, in 605, 606, and then 597 and 586. And so the return would have been 70 years later, which would be 536. And we're right here in Zechariah. Of course, they returned and they began work on the temple, but they had stopped that work on the temple, as you'll remember from our earlier study in the book of Ezra. And Zechariah, of course, is instrumental in getting that effort back in line to rebuild the temple. And so that's a great deal of the encouragement that goes on in the book of Zechariah. So as we look at this particular book, we're looking at somewhere around 510 BC, and Zechariah is not only he's not only rebuking the people for you know, building their houses and not getting the Lord's house in order. But as we get into this last portion of the book of Zechariah in particular, from chapter 6 and onward, we find a lot of prophecy with regard to the spiritual joy that should attend the heritage of these people, that they are looking forward to the Messiah. And so we might not altogether catch that if we're not careful when we look at the book of Zechariah, and I want to make sure that we do. You may recall several weeks ago we saw that, especially in chapter 6, as we saw the prophecy with regard to the Messiah, the branch who would come and would be a priest on his throne. And you'll remember that dual crown that was placed on the head of Joshua, and it became a kind of a symbol as the dual office that the Messiah would take on. Well, right here in this section, it may not look like it at first glance, but in chapters 9 through 11, well, through the end of the book, but chapters 9 through 11 really forms kind of a block within this, particularly when we come to the end of chapter 9 through chapter 10 and through chapter 11. We talk about the past errors of the people and how they had not served the Lord. We'll get into that very, very quickly here in chapter 10. But then he talks about the Messiah, who of course will be the strength. He will be the object of where everything has been going. If we look back in chapter 9, we find that Messiah coming up. As we look in verses 9 through 12, and in particular, we see in verse 9 the prophecy that's cited in the triumphal entry of Jesus into Jerusalem. So you see, the Messiah is not out of sight in all of this, and we're going to see little bits and pieces, and they make sense to us very quickly, because we can go to the New Testament, and the New Testament might actually cite that scripture, like this one in chapter 9 and verse 9. We find it quoted by the gospel writers as Jesus makes that triumphal entry on the donkey, the colt of a donkey. But as we go on, there are other little things that may not look quite so much like the Messiah, but if we think about it, we realize, you know, there's an undertow in this entire prophecy here that has the Messiah coming out to the forefront. And so when we get to the end of chapter 9, verses 16 and 17, the Lord their God will save them in that day. Now, stop right there and think about that for just a moment. What day is that? As we looked earlier, in fact, I preached on this, probably about 4 weeks ago, 4.5 weeks ago, I preached on this phrase being used over and over again in the book of Zechariah, that day, that day. The book of Zechariah is pointing towards something that Zechariah continually calls that day. Well, that day is the day fulfilled in Jesus Christ. And so Jesus Christ comes and he fulfills that, but what will God do? The Lord their God will save them in that day. Now the Jews, they might, in the course of time, as they look at what Zechariah says, they might draw the faulty conclusion that, okay, he's going to save us from the Greeks. Okay, and so we have Judas Maccabeus coming on the scene, and they bolster their courage, and they go into guerrilla warfare mode, and we find them prevailing against the Greeks, and that looks like that's what that's saying. Well, the Lord obviously was going to save them in that instance because the Messiah is going to come, right? But is that really the object of everything that the Lord is doing? The object is about the big picture of sin having entered the world, and he's going to save the world through these people. So the salvation here is going to be the salvation that comes in Jesus Christ. He goes on here, as the flock of his people, save them in that day as the flock of his people, for they are the stones of a crown. Now, of course, I think of a stone, and most of the stones that I see are ground up granite. That's what we got out here in the parking lot. You know, and I'll come in the building and I'll find where a stone got stuck between the tread of someone's shoe and it came off in the hallway, and I'll look down and I'll see it and I'll kick it out the door. I'll pick it up and throw it out. And so when I see stone, I immediately think a stone. But what stone is he talking about? Yeah, we're talking about gemstones here. We're talking about something precious. Think about it for a moment. For they are as the stones of a crown. You gonna put crushed granite in a crown, really? Okay, so it's obviously something that is precious. And what is it? They are as, the people are as, you know, and this is picked up, of course, in the book of Revelation when we see the jewels of that wonderful city. And of course we think, oh, well, we're going to be playing in the jewels. No, the truth is, we're the jewels. We're the jewels. We're that city. We're that beautiful city that's put on display there, the holy city of God. But the people are as the stones of a crown sparkling in his land. For what comeliness and beauty will be theirs? This reminds me of Isaiah's prophecy as he winds up the book of Isaiah and he speaks of the land being called Beulah, beautiful land. For what comeliness and beauty will be theirs? Grain will make the young men flourish and new wine the virgins. And of course, we're immediately thinking, oh, well, agriculture is going to be great. Well, you know, while that's true, That's really not the point that's being made. The point is being made in the nation itself actually flourishing, and what God is going to do to bring that about. And that's going to be developed further. Look at how we begin now in chapter 10. Ask rain from the Lord. Stop right there. What's the rain good for? The crops. What did he just talk about? Grain will make the young men flourish and new wine the virgins. Okay, and so we have the grain, we have the grapes. Ask rain from the Lord at the time of the latter rain. Some versions have spring rain. It's the same thing. It kind of throws people into a dither because when we think of early rain and latter rain, what do we think of? The early rain would be when? In the spring, and the latter rain would be in the fall, okay? That's not what this is. Okay, the rain is not dictated by where it falls in the calendar. It's determined by the rainy season. And the beginning of the rainy season in Israel is actually in the fall of the year. So the early rain is in the fall. You know, so I got to stop and think because I'm thinking early rain. Okay, no. It's early in the rainy season. The early rain is in the fall, and runs through to the spring when we have the resurgence and we have a latter rain. That is in the spring, and the latter rain is associated with the Passover, which of course is in the spring. And I find that interesting because ask rain from the Lord at the time of the latter rain, which is the Passover season. And I'm thinking, you know, the first thing that comes into my mind, I'm thinking, okay, for some reason, the Jews in the first century had an association of the Passover feast with the eventual coming of the Messiah, when the Messiah would come and free his people. And that's when he did, right? He came at the Passover, and he was crucified during that feast. And I'm thinking, okay, well, why did the Jews think that? Maybe they didn't have anything necessarily other than maybe some suppositions, some assumptions, or maybe they saw something like this. And I just kind of wonder, you know, the time of the latter rain, ask rain from the Lord at the time of the latter rain, the Lord who makes the storm clouds, and he will give them showers of rain in order to do what? In order to fulfill verse 17, when grain will make the young men flourish and the new wine the virgins. Now, I'm not saying the Jews understood why the Messiah was coming particularly, because, of course, they were focused on, you know, driving out the Romans and getting a Davidic or a Solomonic kingdom back in place that would bring back those glory days. But they did have that time frame, which is interesting, because if you were going to choose a time in the Jewish festivals, in all of the sacrificial system and the festivals that the Jews had, when would you choose for the Messiah to come? I know when I would choose it. It would just make sense to me. I'd pick the annual Day of Atonement. But Bob, that's wrong, because that's not when God was going to do it. And God chose to do it in the Passover season. And the reason, of course, becomes clearer as we look at what the Passover season was about and what was accomplished in the salvation of the Lord in that particular occasion, and how we might draw type and antitype into that. And the Lord does Passover sin in the sacrifice of Jesus. And of course, that's beautiful, but it's not the first thing that comes into my head. So why were the Jews thinking that? And I look at I'm not saying that that's what this is saying and that they were concluding that by this. I'm just saying that, you know, I find that so compelling. I find that so interesting. But then we have something interesting in verse 2. Because verse 2 now begins to talk about idolatry. This is exactly where we left off last time. I asked you about the teraphim. Let me test your 3-week-old memory. What was a teraphim? Yeah, it was a household idol. And I gave you the example Jacob in Laban's house. And when they fled from the face of Laban, Rachel grabbed the household idols. And, of course, the question becomes, and household idols, by the way, that, I mean, they weren't a great monetary value, but they held a superstitious, idolatrous value for Laban in you know, what they believed that they would do for the fertility of the women in the house, of the fertility of the fields, of the prosperity of the household, and they would actually consult the idols. And so he says here, the teraphim speak iniquity. The diviners see lying visions and tell false dreams. They comfort in vain. And this verse 2 makes it sound like they have idols among them, doesn't it? Makes it sound like the Israelites right here in this point in time that they have idols there among them. And yet that's not really necessarily what this is saying, because there really is no evidence that the Israelites ever went back to idolatry. Now, there are two possibilities here. The first possibility is that he's talking about the teraphim and the diviners of the nations around about, or the embedded mongrel, later to be known as Samaritan peoples, and it's them. I don't think, however, that that's what we're dealing with here. I think he's going back and he's telling them that this is what led to the situation as it exists now. Lying idols, lying diviners, they do nothing but destroy, and this is what has come to here, brought us to here. He simply states it as a fact. For the teraphim speak iniquity, the diviners see lying visions and tell false dreams, they comfort in vain. Therefore, the people wander like sheep, they are afflicted because there is no shepherd. That's where they came to, isn't it? That's what happened to them. And they fell away, and of course, they were taken off into captivity. But then he states the result in verse 3. My anger is kindled against the shepherds, and I will punish the male goats, for the Lord of hosts has visited his flock, the house of Judah, and will make them like his majestic horse in battle. Now, notice the switch here. We've got a very quick turn into verse 3, and he very quickly turns around to go to an anger kindled against the shepherds. Notice at the end of verse 2, they are afflicted because there is no shepherd. And then he says, my anger is kindled against the shepherds, and I will punish the male goats. And I believe that perhaps he's talking about the governors of the people, not the Jews themselves, but the governors placed over the people by the Medo-Persian empire. But he says, for the Lord of hosts has visited his flock, the house of Judah. Now, when the scriptures say that the Lord has visited, what does that mean? The Lord of hosts has visited. Okay. The Lord visited his people in the coming of Jesus. The Lord visited his people when they were in Egyptian bondage. And so this is exactly what we have. We have the Lord visiting his people, and it's the concept of visiting upon them in accordance with his desire, with what he wants. Now, it's possible to visit upon a people wrath. And you don't want the Lord visiting you then, do you? So what we have here, however, is we have the benevolent visit that God says that he makes. And he says he has visited his flock, the house of Judah. So keep that in mind. The house of Judah is called his flock, and will make them like his majestic horse in battle. What do you think a majestic horse looks like? Well decorated. Strong. A noble steed. Sure-footed. Who would be on it? A king. A general, a commander, it's not going to be just anybody. It won't be just anyone. And so, what does he describe here? He says he will make them, in other words, the house of Judah, he will make them like his majestic horse in battle. So there are two images going on here. First of all, and they both surround the idea of Judah, his people, which, as we'll see, it also wraps up the idea of Ephraim as well. It's not just Judah, but he only calls them out here. The first is the idea of the majestic horse, and he makes them as a majestic horse. And so the majestic horse is something that, of course, the Jews typically did not have in their history. They did from time to time, but this was normally something that was had by the more dominant nations that became world powers, like Egypt, Syria did. They had their horses and their chariots. We find, of course, the Babylonians. We have the Medo-Persians, later on the Grecians. The idea of the majestic horse is that of something that is suited for battle in such a way that it's glorious. It's highly decorated. There is a great deal of ornate decoration upon it, and it exudes the idea of that which is truly wonderful and splendid. Now, the second thing that is brought out is that the horse is in battle. It's not just a show horse. And so there's the idea of conflict now suddenly introduced in this. I will make them like his majestic horse in battle. From them will come the cornerstone. Now, verse 4, let me first say of verse 4, there are different ideas on verse 4. I'm going to tell you what I think it means, and I may be wrong, but I believe that it fits the flow overall for what the Messiah is going to be doing. And so from them will come the cornerstone. I'm sorry, but I cannot resist Jesus in that. Not that he's expressing the idea of the church, and that may be on his mind. I know he already knows that the Messiah is going to come and build the church, but the whole idea is of what the cornerstone will be, and that's exactly what the Messiah would be, not just with regard to the church, but with regard to the entire plan of God. So from them will come the cornerstone. And by the way, the word them in the New American Standard here, that can be translated him or them. And I've seen the linguists bat that back and forth, and I think, okay, well, you guys aren't going to solve that. I know each side thinks they've solved it, but, you're not going to solve that. I'm going to draw a conclusion from what I think the context is saying, and we'll just leave it at that. So if you see him in your version and you're saying, well, Bob, it doesn't say them, it says him, him or them will work in the text. From them, the tent peg. Now, the question becomes one of whether the tent peg is referring to what is driven into the ground in order to hold the tent up, or the peg that's utilized within the tent in order to hang things. Either way, it's a very poignant picture of God's intention and what he desires. From them, the bow of battle. And of course, the Lord, I immediately think of the picture of the white horse and the Messiah on that white horse in the book of Revelation, that concept of him going out to conquer the souls of men. From them, every ruler, all of them together, the ruler here, that can actually be translated oppressor, but I don't believe that it's intended to be the oppressor. They will be as mighty men, is the point, as stated in verse 5. It says, treading down the enemy in the mire of the streets in battle. We go back to the idea of the majestic horse in battle, and the horse treading down in the battle. They will fight for the Lord, will be with them. the riders on horses will be put to shame. We're talking about Judah and Ephraim here, these people, their descendants. Verse 6, "And I shall strengthen the house of Judah, and I shall save the house of Joseph." Notice how we've put the two together. And as I pointed out a few months ago, as some people try to make out, like, well, you know, only Judah and Levi actually came back in the return. That's not borne out in the prophets, actually. Borne out in the prophets is the fact that there was a return of all. And we discussed that. He says, "And I shall bring them back because I have had compassion on them." But now, wait a minute, right here, I have to stop. I will bring them back. What does he mean by that? Because where are they now? They're back from captivity, right? Okay, so if they've already come back, then why is he saying that I will bring them back? And so that arrests my attention right there, and I have to stop and I have to think, okay, well, is the middle of verse 6 talking about bringing them back from captivity? But he says, "I shall bring them back because I have had compassion on them." And I think that it's not back from that captivity that he's talking about. What captivity might he be talking about? Okay, captivity of sin. Sin is the scourge that God has been concerned with from the very beginning of time, when Adam and Eve fell. And so the bringing back and the compassion here, then the next line, "And they will be as though I had not rejected them." He had rejected them, but there's going to come a time when it's as though he had not. And when will that be? Will it be when they're fighting the Maccabean War against the Greeks? Will it be when they're unable to worship in their temple because Antiochus Epiphanes has defiled it? Is it going to be when the Romans come into town and they're just pushing them down? Is it going to be when the city of Jerusalem is destroyed by the Romans in AD 70? And I'm thinking here that, okay, he says, "And they will be as though I had not rejected them." And I don't think that comes in the Jews themselves getting back in their land and having, for example, having Herod's temple so beautiful and ornate. It's still not as though he had never rejected them, because that's still on the landscape, the political landscape, totally, constantly has that in it. But when the Messiah brings his kingdom, it doesn't. When the Messiah brings his kingdom, everything, how do the prophets put that again? Is made new. Okay, and we have the new covenant, Jeremiah 31, and this new covenant brings about a whole new life for mankind. "For I am the Lord their God, and I will answer them." Possibly a reference back to verse 1. Because he's just out of the blue, he says, "I will answer them." Answer them? What? Well, the chapter begins, "Ask rain from the Lord." And you'll remember that the rain we referred that to be would probably be more the spiritual rain of joy in the Messiah and not the literal latter rains that might come. Okay, so that takes us down through verse 6. We have some more description here. Any questions? Yeah. Yeah. They won't see their, you know, as we talked about in the past, there's an aspect of prophecy where things are hidden. Paul specifically makes that reference to the idea of the Gentiles being included. And so in Ephesians chapter 3, he calls that a mystery. And of course, some today take that to mean that we still have mysteries that we don't understand, you know, and, you know, we need, you know, a clergy or prophets or whatever to explain it to us. And in actuality, what we have is something that was a mystery in the Old Testament, and it was actually mentioned, it was brought out. For example, in the book of Amos, we talked about that Sunday morning, where we have reference to the fact that the Gentiles will be brought in. But the way that would happen, they would not understand until Jesus does come and bring it about. And so much of this is understood in a physical way. And we can look at them and we could say, why couldn't they see? Well, the truth is they had lived in a kingdom that had always been physical. And the blessings of God had always been so physical. And everything tied to their spiritual well-being had always been so physical. All these sacrifices. And everything was so physical. And so I can't blame them. I mean, if I'd been living at that time and I was reading this stuff, I would think it was literal rain. I would think that everything, you know, and, you know, so many, well, I say so many, the popular prophecy scholars of our day who write their commentaries, they will tell us that, well, you can't take that literalism and make anything spiritual out of it. It's actually intended to be. But the truth is, there is a spiritual message there. And we see it in the way it is fulfilled in what the New Testament writers actually tell us came about. Okay. I think I answered your question. Did I? Okay. Just making sure. Angelica? Okay, not sure, not certain. There are a couple of possibilities there. One is the shepherds and the goats they're understood to be the governors and the priests, and they might be from among the mongrel peoples, like the who would become known as the Samaritans in the New Testament. You may remember that when we began to study Ezra, they came and they wanted to help build the house of the Lord. And Zerubbabel said, no, you have no part in this. And so they started attacking them and working against them. It's a good chance that that's who we're talking about. The second possibility is that we are talking about governors that were set in place by the Medo-Persian Empire and what they were trying to do to govern those people, and not exactly nurturing them in a spiritual way toward Jehovah. So. Okay, yeah. So we're just not exactly sure which. Of course, they would know. I like to point out to people, you know, we read passages sometimes and we'd like to be able to say, well, it's definitely this right here. But there may be another possibility. There may be two or three other possibilities. But the thing you have to remember is that the people who are first receiving it, they knew exactly what the... It's like the book of Revelation. I mean, we look at the book of Revelation and everybody debates, well, when was it written? You know, when did he receive the revelation? Who was the emperor on the throne? Well, I'll tell you what, I do know this. I do know the people who were reading this from Ephesus all the way down to Laodicea in chapters 2-3, they knew who was on the throne, whether I know it or not. And I think I can tell you who was on the throne from what I read in chapter 17, but they did know, without a doubt. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, right. Well, they had no rightful shepherd, and the shepherds who were there did not have a right to play the role of shepherd that they were playing. That's the way that I would read that. Okay, so that was the first bell. Okay, let me try to get to my stopping place here, which I won't make because it was actually into chapter 11. like that's never happened. Verse 7, and Ephraim will be like a mighty man. Notice how Ephraim is brought into this. Their heart will be glad as if from wine. Indeed, their children will see it and be glad. Their heart will rejoice in the Lord. I will whistle for them to gather them together. Well, now, wait a minute. They're already in the land. Okay, so I'm thinking, okay, there's something more going on that needs to be taken into consideration. And he says, for I have redeemed them, and they will be as numerous as they were before. When I scatter them among the peoples, they will remember me in far countries. And they, with their children, will live and come back. And I will bring them back from the land of Egypt and gather them from Assyria. Now, take note of those two places. If you don't want to write in your Bible and to make note of it, you might just put it on a note on a separate piece of paper, perhaps. But here at the beginning of verse 10, he mentions the land of Egypt, and he mentions Assyria, and he mentions Gilead and Lebanon. Okay, when he mentions Gilead and Lebanon, we're going to find that popping up in chapter 11. And if you forget that you read about it in chapter 10, you're going to start reading chapter 11. Open your doors, O Lebanon, that a fire may feed on your cedars. And you're thinking, how did they get into this? Okay, well, they got into this because he brought them up earlier. The same is true. Where is Asher? I lost it, but you'll see it further down in there. And, of course, we have that already brought up. We have Egypt brought up and goes to chapter 10 and verse 11. We have Egypt, and there's Assyria. Asher will be brought down. And so we have all of this from verse 10 now working into the rest of the chapter and down into chapter 11. And before I run out of time, nope, bell didn't ring. Usually I say that and the bell rings. Before I run out of time, I want you, if you want to just kind of make a note on a piece of paper for how to study chapter 11, we're going to divide chapter 11 into three parts. Verses 1 through 3, verses 4 through 14, and then verses 15 through 17. Verses 1 through 3 will seem very chaotic and out of place, but verses 1 through 3 makes perfect sense after you've read verses 4 through 17, especially verses 15 through 17, because that will help us to understand why all this judgment is going on in verses 1 through 3. So if you'll study it, the way I did it this afternoon is I read verses 15 through 17 first, and then I read verses 4 through 14, and then I read verses 1 through 3. And it kind of helped me, and I may be the only crazy person in the room that that does help, but it helped me. So you might try it. If it doesn't help, just go back to 1 through 17, I guess. But that's what we have there. Okay, I don't really have time to do much else. Let me pick up next time in verse 8. We need to talk about him whistling to gather them together when it seems like they're already gathered together. Give thought to that with the concept of what happens in the New Testament. Okay? Try to imagine how the New Testament might fit into that, and we'll discuss that next Wednesday night. Okay, thank you very much.